Hey listeners, welcome back to another episode of Crime Life. I'm your host, Heather. Today's episode is going to be on The Boy in the Box, which is also known as America's Unknown Child. This case has been unsolved for over 60 years. I have been obsessed with this case for who knows how long. I can't even remember when I got into it, but it's just one of those cases that you just wish would be solved. So let's get right into it. Today's case is just one of many that's on my list that I want to get into. When I talk about unsolved cases, which ones pop into your head? I mean, I have the Black Dahlia, Jack the Ripper, hell, Tupac Shakur, JonBenet Ramsey, the list can go on and on. On the evening of February 23, 1957, in Fox Chase, Philadelphia, a young man who still remains unnamed went to check on his muskrat traps when he came upon a baby bassinet box with a dead body in it. Knowing that his muskrat traps were illegal, this gentleman decided not to report the body. But 2 days later, a college student parked his car off Susquehanna Road and began to hike across a vacant lot in the rain to spy on some Catholic girls. His name was Frederick Benosis. He came across the box that will now make him forget why he was there to begin with. It was a cardboard box, looked like trash, until he looked inside of it and saw a small body stuffed inside. He then ran back to his car. He thought it was a doll or maybe even a little girl. But he didn't report it either, because he had a history with the police of being a peeping Tom. But the next day, he heard on the radio about a 4-year-old missing girl and thought, could this be the box that I saw? He then went to the police to report it, but the little girl would be found a week later. She had wandered into a vacant home near her own home to play and got locked in a closet and ended up starving to death before she was found a week later. It's a very sad story, but unlike this one, that one was accidental and solved right away. This would be the beginning of a long, heartbreaking story that the end has yet to be written. The officers who arrived at the location on February 24th found a large cardboard carton lying on its side, opened on one end. The box had once held a baby bassinet from JCPenney. Inside that box was a small boy, his pale white body wrapped in a cheap imitation Indian blanket. They searched the lot, and 17 feet from that box, they discovered a man's cap made from royal blue corduroy with a leather strap and a buckle on the back. An autopsy was performed on the boy by Dr. Joseph Spellman, who was the chief medical examiner at the time in Philadelphia. His report placed the boy between 4 and 6 years old. The reason such a big gap was made because of the size. He had blue eyes, light blonde hair. He had a fresh, bad haircut. It was short in some spots and almost bald in the other ones. It definitely looked as if someone did it at home either right before his death or after, because he still had hair clippings on his body. He was 41 inches tall and only weighed a measly 30 pounds at the time of his death. That's so tiny, guys. Dr. Spellman reported the cause of his death was a savage beating that left the boy's body and face covered in fresh bruises. He had older markings and scars on his body also. There was an L-shaped scar that was right on his chin, a 1-inch surgical scar on the left side of his chest, a round wonky-like scar on his left elbow, a well-healed scar at the groin, apparently from hernia surgery, and a scar on the left ankle that resembled a cut-down incision used to expose veins for a blood transfusion. The boy was circumcised but had no vaccination marks. The medical examiner had a lengthy report. Like, it had so many details in it, it was pages long. The boy showed a long history of abuse. The victim's right palm and soles of his feet were rough and wrinkled. It suggested that he had been submerged in water, either immediately before or after his death. You will hear this often because a lot of this is still unknown to what was done before he died or what was done after he died. When exposed to an ultraviolet light, the boy's left eye radiated a bright blue, which indicated recent exposure to a diagnostic dye used in the treatment of chronic eye disease. The medical examiner reported the boy's death to head trauma, probably inflicted with a blunt object, but he could not rule out that damage had been done by pressure, which prompted some of the investigators to believe it could have been inflicted by someone squeezing the boy's head when he was given his haircut. Detectives dressed and propped up the boy up to take a picture of him to put on flyers. They were hoping to find out who the boy's name was, but no names, no leads for years had come. This case had become cold. Investigators initially focused on the box that had been used to discard the boy in. It had originally used for a baby bassinet from JCPenney and was one of a dozen received on November 27, 1956 and sold for $7.50. Between December 3, 1956 and February 16, 1957, from a store in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, is where this 12 baby bassinets were sold. The reason detectives were able to pinpoint the store and the date was because the serial number was still visible on the box. Only downside is the store did not keep records of sales. But the other 11 bassinets were eventually located by detectives. The sales rep even remembers a gentleman buying bassinets around that time, but he paid cash, so she didn't have any receipt with the name, and that was also a dead end. FBI fingerprint technicians found no prints on the cardboard box used to throw this poor little child away. They then examined the blanket for any leads, but that also became just as frustrating. It was made from cheap cotton, flannel, and had been recently washed. It had been cut into two separate unequal pieces and then wrapped around the naked boy. Analysis of the blanket determined that it had been manufactured either in North Carolina or Quebec, which are two huge different places. Which would lead us nowhere, because initially blankets had been produced by thousands. The police were never able to figure out the exact place where it had been sold, so that did the same thing as the bassinet box, led us to a dead end. The label inside of the blue cap that was found just feet away from the baby's bassinet took police to Robin's Eagle Hat and Cap Company in Philadelphia. The owner of that hat store, whose name is Hannah Robbins, said that it was one of 12 that had been made from corduroy. At some point before May of 1956, she recalled a particular hat that had been made without a leather strap. But the gentleman that bought it was in his late 20s. He had come back a few months later to have a strap sewn on it. Robbins told the detectives that her customer resembled photographs that she had been seen of the boy in the box, but she had no record of his name or address either. It truly sucks that all these records had nothing to lead a trail anywhere. But I also understand that back then in the 50s, technology was different. Philadelphia police circulated more than 10,000 flyers with the child's photograph on them to police departments throughout eastern Philadelphia and southern New Jersey, but with no results. The Philadelphia Gas Works mailed out 200,000 flyers. 300,000 flyers in all were circulated. An article about this case was written in the law enforcement's bulletin, again without producing any worthwhile leads. Someone somewhere knew who this boy was and what happened to him, but they're not talking. 5 months after the boy was found, nothing had come to find out who this boy was or who could have disposed of him the way they did. The authorities came together and buried him at the Philadelphia's Potter's Field, near the state hospital at Bibury, which at the time was a mental institute. The detectives who worked on this case together collected enough money to put a headstone on the young boy's grave, which actually was the only headstone in that graveyard at the time. The headstone read, "Heavenly Father, bless this unknown boy." Like most unsolved murders, there have been a number of theories that have come into the light. A number of people thought that this boy was the son of a roofer in New Jersey. Authorities found that roofer's estranged wife, who did not believe that the child was her son. When the roofer was finally found, his son was there next to him eating a sandwich watching TV. That one's checked off the list now. Another possibility was that the boy was Stephen Damon, a boy who went missing in New Jersey on Halloween in 1955. Marilyn Damon left her two children outside while she went into the grocery store. When she returned, they were gone. The infant, Pamela, was found a block away still strapped into her car seat. Stephen was nowhere to be found. He would have been roughly the same age, blonde-haired, blue-eyed little boy in the box. He also had a matching scar beneath his chin. However, Damon had broken his arm, and the boy in the box did not have evidence of a broken bone. The 1998 DNA test finally confirmed that the boy in the box was not Stephen Damon, who till this day has never been found. In 1961, a pair of carnies were arrested for the death of their daughter, who was found in the woods wrapped in a blanket, and dead from abuse and malnutrition. The pair had 10 children and several were missing. It was eventually discovered that 4 of their other children had died due to this neglect and abuse, but none of their children were the boy in the box. This doesn't mean there haven't been theories and leads over these years. One suggests that the boy might have been an immigrant, but all immigrants have to be vaccinated. This boy had not been. An informant remembered seeing a woman and a boy by the side of the road unloading a box from the trunk of their car. When he stopped to help, thinking they may have had a flat tire, they didn't say a word to him and seemed to move to hide their identity, the car license plate, and anything that would possibly give them away. Police couldn't locate that woman or the boy, but several years later, a woman was arrested for throwing away the body of her 3-year-old daughter. She fit the description of this woman, but after questioning, it was determined she had nothing to do with the boy in the box case. I'm throwing a lot of theories out here, but it just shows you how it was all over the place back then. Now, I can't find anything on Frederick Benosis, who was the college student who found the body and reported it to police. He may have had some involvement, but the 26-year-old college student did voluntarily take a lie detector test and was cleared, so who knows where he is at now. This case went cold and silent until November 4th, 1998, when the boy in the box was exhumed in order to extract DNA. A year passed before the authorities finally admitted that they had not been able to obtain a usable DNA profile from the boy's remains. In 1999, Frank Benner, a forensic artist sculptor, he decided to sculpt a bust that he had believed would bear a strong resemblance to the dead boy's father. The case was profiled for a national television audience on America's Most Wanted, but no leads were discovered. No matter what effort these detectives continued to do, they were identifying this boy at any cost, but just were not getting any answers. Another attempt was made in 2000. This time from the boy's teeth, but this attempt also failed. They did a third attempt, and it was reported to be successful in April of 2001. Finding any living relatives seems hopeless, but the detectives are staying optimistic. Most of these theories have been dismissed, but there's 3 possible solutions that create interest in recent years. This first big theory, which was eventually ruled out, involved a foster home that was located a little more than a mile from the vacant lot where the boys' body was found. The foster home was ran by Arthur and Catherine Nicoletti. In 1960, Remington Bristow, an employee of the medical examiner's office who pursued the case until his own death in 1993, contacted a New Jersey psychic who told him to look for a house that seemed to match the foster home. When the psychic was brought to the city, she led Bristow straight to that house. Bristow refused to let it go, investigating the case on his own. When he attended an estate sale at that foster home, Bristow discovered a bassinet similar to the one sold at JCPenney. He also saw blankets hanging on the clothesline similar to that which the boy's body had been wrapped in. Bristow believed that the child belonged to the stepdaughter of the man who ran this foster home. He believed that the stepfather was involved in a sexual relationship with the girl and she had become pregnant. The boy was hidden away, but when he died accidentally, the man disposed of the boy so that the girl would not be exposed as an unwed mother, because back in 1957, being an unwed mother was frowned upon. Despite the circumstantial evidence, the police were unable to find any real links between the family and the boy in the box. In 1998, Philadelphia Police Lieutenant Tom Augustine, who remains in charge of this investigation, interviewed the stepfather, who was the man that ran that foster home, and the daughter, whom he is now married to. Wow. Why that was allowed or where the mother was is unknown. The interview seemed to confirm to them that the family was not involved in this case. After a DNA test, which ruled out the stepdaughter as the boy's mother, the investigation of the foster home theory was closed. I'm sure the detectives felt like they were finally getting close to some kind of answers, but nothing again came of this. Now, the second big theory emerged on February 2002 by a woman identified as Mary, which in some articles you will see that she will only identify as M, but she claims that her abusive mother purchased this unknown boy named Jonathan from his birth parents in the summer of 1954. The boy was subjected to extreme physical and sexual abuse for 2.5 years, which could explain the scars and the marks. She said her mother then allegedly killed the boy in a fit of rage when he vomited in the bathtub, which could be the dark substance that was found in his throat. The woman then cut the boy's long hair, explaining why it was jagged and uneven, and dumped the body in the secluded vacant lot. Mary went on to say that as they were preparing to remove the boy's body from the trunk, when a passing male motorist pulled alongside them to ask if they needed assistance, they ignored him and he eventually drove away. Could this child be a victim of human trafficking who was purchased by this woman? The story matched a testimony given by a male witness in 1957. The police considered the story quite plausible, and the investigators were convinced that Mary was telling the truth. However, when Mary's name was leaked to the press, she left the country and no further efforts have been made to investigate this curious case of America's unknown child, which sucks so bad because if you have a history of mental illness, you now become this person that makes stuff up or you couldn't possibly be telling the truth. Although her fleeing the country didn't help her, I wish they would have pursued her still. Neighbors who have had access to that house that were neighbors with Mary denied that there had ever been a young boy living there, and they said that Mary's story was just ridiculous. Let's be honest, not all neighbors talk or come out of their houses. Some don't even know who their neighbors are. It's totally shit that the neighbors were able to say whatever they wanted about Mary, and the detectives believed it just like that. I can tell you, I've lived in my community for 2 years, and I definitely don't know all my neighbors. Who knows who I could be living next to? All I'm saying is not all neighbors are social and know about who they live next to. So I hate that they were able just to let this theory go. But let's get back to this unknown, unclaimed child. This third theory was a man who reported to the Philadelphia Police Department that his older half-brother had gone missing around that same time period. He said that his sibling's disappearance was a long-time family secret. Now, remember that bust that forensic sculptor Frank Bender had made? This gentleman said that it looked like his own father, who was now dead, but no connection was ever made. It's been 63 years now, and this case is still unsolved. I'm sure there's slim chances it will ever get solved, but it's one that I wish and is on my list. I know last year in 2019, I read an article that they believe it could have been the year, but nothing has come of it. David Stout, which is a former New York Times reporter and an author of the 2008 book called The Boy in the Box, The Unsolved Case of America's Unknown Child, stated, "I believe it would take an out-of-the-blue surprise to ever identify this boy and then possibly find out who killed him." It's such a sad story. Now, amateur genealogist expert Barbara Ray Venter, who's the one who helped crack that Golden State Killer case in 2018 using DNA and genetic research, she confirmed to the Mercury News in August 2018 that she was working on the Boy in the Box case. So my fingers are crossed. Police are asking anybody who's over 55 years old or older if they remember from the early 1950s a young boy possibly named Jonathan living in or within a 40-mile radius of Philadelphia to contact them. They also are hoping for a tip from a current or retired physician who may have treated such a boy for a condition that would have left him scars in the groin area or even the ankles. If you have any tips, you can leave your tip at americasunknownchild.net. Someone out there knows who this child was. Someone had to have seen this little boy. Could that someone be you or someone in your family who lived in Philadelphia? At least for now, this mystery remains unsolved. That's all I got for today's episode. As much as I wish that I had a more positive ending to it, or at least an answer, I don't, and this is one that I hope to get out that someone could somewhere give a tip. If you guys like what you hear, please make sure you check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/crimelifepodcast. Make sure you like it and share it. You can also check out our website at crimelifepodcast.com. If you have any episode suggestions or just want to hit me up, you can email me at crimelifepodcast@gmail.com. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, stay obsessed with crime life.